Welcome to the Who God Says podcast. I am your host and Kingdom Ambassador, Tyshandra. Hi, hi, hi. Today we have a special guest. He is a speaker, an author, a pastor, and a father of 10. Oh my God. Scott LaPierre. Yay!
Hi, Tyshandra. Thanks for having me on the show. Glad to be here with you and your listeners.
Oh my gosh. Whew. Father of 10. That's a big job.
It is. Yep.
And I don't know your wife, but I love her already.
She is a wonderful woman. Yeah, it's funny. You know, people are always shocked. You know, you have they're like, they can't believe I have 10 kids. And I'm like, look, I can't believe I have 10 kids. I'm shocked too. That makes two of us. We just got married and wanted to let God give us the kids that he thought was turn that over to him. You know, people say, did you want to have a lot of kids? And it was, I wouldn't say it that way. I would say we wanted to have what God wanted us to have. So we just left. Could have been 3, 4, 5, you know, whatever it was, 12, just one of his fingerprints on our family.
Oh, that's so sweet. Oh my God. Oh, just think about the amount of grandbabies you're going to have.
We'll see. Hopefully, yeah.
Ooh, oh my gosh. My mom had 9. And so I think she has like 15 grandchildren and about the same in great grand. Yeah. Ooh, that's a big one. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Okay. I mean, you know, God is with you. That's all I can say. Okay, so today I wanted to talk about kingdom finances. You know, finances for, this is a tricky subject because a lot of people, they kind of stay away from money talk, especially in Christians.
Well said.
So you have a book called Your Finances, God's Way. What led you to write that book? What are some of the circumstances around deciding to write that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you said something interesting there that I agree with, that finances or money can kind of be a taboo topic for Christians or in the church. And, you know, if I preach on prayer or forgiveness or love or, you know, Christ's deity, then everyone says, oh, that's spiritual. That makes mm-hmm. sense. You know, that's biblical. But you come in and talk about finances and people are kind of like, well, this doesn't seem spiritual. But I would say that we determine what's spiritual by the attention God's word gives it. Or maybe a better way to say it is, the more frequently something is discussed in God's word, the more spiritual it is. God's word determines what's spiritual or Christian, let's say, for us. And if the amount of attention something receives reveals the its spirituality or relationship to the Christian life, then few things have as much attention in God's word as finances. It's actually one of the most common topics, which tells us that it should be one of the most common topics in our lives, from the pulpit, you know, in Bible studies, right up there with those other common topics like love, forgiveness, worship, service. And so I generally preach verse by verse expositionally through books of the Bible. And so I was encountering verses on finances. But the real reason I decided to write it, and I don't really have the bandwidth to write separately from my preaching. So if I have a book, that means I preached on that, because, you know, and so I pour over my sermons. I put a ton of hours of study and labor into my notes. You know, some pastors kind of have abbreviated notes when they preach. I generally write out a pretty thorough manuscript. And my wife kept telling me, you really need to put these into a book. And I kept putting her off because I was already so busy. And that, so my first book was marriage, because I preached on marriage at the church pretty much for the same reason I preached on finances, which I'll explain in just a moment. And and it was supposed to be the marriage month, and it ended up being the marriage year, because I just kept preaching more sermons on it. It was seemed to be received well, you know, as I was reading the congregation's interest. And Katie said, hey, that needs to be your first book. And so I put that book together from those sermons. And so that, I guess that's one good thing about my books, that they're thoroughly studied. I mean, because they come from my sermons. So they're going to be, even if you didn't like my books, I hope you couldn't say they weren't biblical. You know, I hope you couldn't say they weren't drawn from, even if you had other criticisms about them, I don't think you could say they're not biblical. And so I preached on marriage at my church because I saw the need for that. And that's pretty much the same reason that I preached on finances, because I saw the need for people to be equipped in this very important area. Yes. I was doing counseling and seeing people struggle with their finances or not even. And what's interesting is frequently my marriage counseling became financial counseling because often one of the most common problems in marriage is finances. You have someone who, there's a few reasons that happens. You have one person who saves and one person who's a big spender, right? Mm-hmm. Or the other problem is you have two people who are big spenders and then they end up being in debt and they're hurting financially and they're coming in and they're like, look, our marriage is struggling. We're hurting because we're in so much debt. And then the other thing is there's anxiety from marriage, from financial problems. Mm-hmm. Like when you have bills you can't pay, when you don't feel like you have the money to make it through the month or the week, when you're already kind of maxed out. And Katie and I can relate to this, having a lot of kids and being in ministry, that when you're kind of maxed out, you don't have as much patience for each other. And so it's common for Katie and me to say, hey, look, we have to remind ourselves, look, we're not upset with each other. There's just this other stress in our lives that's causing us to be impatient or short with each other. Well, when people, because finances are one of the biggest causers of stress or anxiety in people's lives, when people are anxious or stressed about finances, they tend to take it out on their spouse or their families. And so that's why you end up talking about finances, because you're talking to people and you find out you're just super stressed out about money. And so you're bringing that home and you're taking it out on your family. And so I just found myself talking a lot about finances with people, wanting Christians to be equipped, my church in particular, in this area, because it is such an important stewardship. There's kind of that idea, which I agree with, that if you want to know what people value, you look at their calendar or their checkbook, which is to say you look at how they spend their time or their money. And you can learn much about people by looking at either of those and seeing what's important to them. And so to me, I also just wanted people to be good stewards. So it's not even like my book. I wouldn't say my book is just packed with all this great financial counsel, although there's financial advice in it. It's primarily about being a good steward or using the money you have to serve the Lord or glorify Him. So it's not like if someone said, hey, if I read your finance book, am I going to become rich? I would say, no, that's not, I didn't write the book to make everyone rich. You know, you can go read a secular book if you want to learn about, my book's more about how to be a good steward, to use the finances God gives us to bring Him glory. And there's a lot of counsel, especially in Proverbs, to handle finances. What you can definitely increase the amount of wealth you have by applying God's word. You know, if you're wise and you apply just the book of Proverbs financially, you'll see your wealth increase because God's word is practical. There is pragmatic or good advice for us, especially in Proverbs. But that's not the main issue. It's not like as Christians, hey, let's all try to make as much money as we can and become millionaires. It's more like, let's use the money God's given us to serve Him and serve others.
Yeah. Good stewardship. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Now I've got to take a little bit of the note that you said, look at someone's checkbook or their calendar, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to use that because I'm now in a dating pool. So I was like, let me see your calendar. Let's see there you if go. That works.
There you go. I know for my daughters, when they, you know, when guys are, my daughter, my oldest is going to be 17. She's our oldest of 10 is going to be 17. And so, and I think she, you know, she's a beautiful young lady and I can imagine young guys being interested in her. She's a little young to be getting married, but she's grown up, you know, watching her mother. She's had a bunch of siblings. So I think she's could be a wife or a mother a lot earlier than many women. But anyway, if young guys, you know, are interested and they come and talk to me, which is the way that it should work. And I hope my daughter Rhea would direct, you know, she would direct guys to come talk to me to get my blessing. That's definitely what I'm trying to figure out is, hey, what does your time and money look like? You know, how are you spending your time and your money? Because that's about as important as it can get in terms of me determining whether you're going to get to marry my daughter or not.
Oh, okay, Papa. Ooh, it's good to get a little insight from the dad's perspective of like, okay, getting a lot of little nuggets. That's good. Ooh. Okay, what are some of the struggles that you had with your finances as it pertains to your family? And I know that you're a pastor, so also like with your church.
Yeah, so I think I probably have some credibility to talk about finances, not because we have a lot of money, but because we didn't have a lot of money, if that makes sense. I mean, if someone yes. comes along, you know, and they're like a millionaire and they tell you, hey, if you want to get out of debt or you want to save money and someone's got millions of dollars, it's kind of like, well, of course you can, you know, get out of debt, or of course you can save a lot. You've got a lot, you know,
right.
But we've always been a single income family. And before I was a pastor, I was an elementary school teacher. And so neither of these professions really make a lot of money. And I'm not looking for, you know, pity or sympathy or something. God's always provided for us. And I do right. want to give him that glory, give him the credit for how he's taken care of us and be thankful for that. So I wouldn't want to sound critical or negative. Yeah. But with that said, neither of us, well, when we got married, Katie was a substitute teacher until we had our first child, and she got pregnant probably like a month after we were married. So we've never been a double income family, and she's been home with our kids. And so we always had to try to, you know, make do with what we had. And so that required, so if you want to talk about challenges, that's one of the challenges was trying to pay off debt, trying to save while you might not have the biggest income, and you're trying to raise a bunch of kids. And so, you know, that there's a lot of decisions we made that, a lot of sacrifice could be involved in that. I got to give credit to my wife for trying to be frugal. You know, this means shopping at Goodwill. This means a lot of people in the church have given us nice clothes. I think we've gotten bags of clothes, and it's almost like the people didn't even wear the clothes before. Wow. And so I think that's probably one of the bigger challenges, and just trying to make do with less money. But I think we're one of the wealthiest nations. I guess I wouldn't even say one of, I should say it like this. We're not just the wealthiest nation in the world. We're the wealthiest nation throughout all of human history. Mm. And so the level of poverty, and I read about this in my book, most people who are near the poverty level in our country are still wealthier than 90-something percent of the rest of the people in the world. So in other words, even the poorest people in our country are still wealthier. And some people, and if someone said, well, the cost of living is higher in the United States, that's true. But even when you adjust, and I wrote about all this in my book, explained it, did all the research, even when you adjust for the cost of living, then the United States still has a level of wealth that's, you know, 10, 20, 30 times higher than most other places throughout the world and throughout human history. And so my point is, most of us don't have an income problem. We have spending problems, right? It's not usually an issue of needing to make more money. It's usually an issue of needing to be wiser with the money that we make. And I've had, when people come in to get financial counseling from me, I'll tell them, I'd like you to come in with your last 3 months of income, pay stubs or income, and your expenses. And so what happens is you sit down with people, and I'll just use some round numbers here. Let's say that they make $7,000 per month. And they have like a $3,000 mortgage, and maybe they have like $2,000 car payments. And so they say, hey, we make $7,000. We only have $3,000 for the mortgage, $2,000 for our car payments. We should have $2,000 left over every month, or $3,000, you know, where's this money going? We can barely make ends meet. Well, you look and then you start seeing where all this extra money is going. And when people can limit or even eliminate many of those expenses, they find their money can go much further. And so that's generally, it's not usually like get together with people and say, hey, this is how you need to go ask for a raise. You need to make more money. It's usually like, here's how you, let's talk about how you can be wiser with the income that you have.
Let's take a quick break.
Hi, everyone. Join the Kingdom Fanatics community. Get exclusive content, green room access with our guests, and more. Visit our website at whogodsays.com. Like and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel. We greatly appreciate your love and support. To find all information on joining our community, being a guest on the show, donating on our PayPal donation page, and more, visit us at whogodsays.com. Now back to the show.
Yeah, yep. I deal with that pretty much daily. I'm a tax accountant, so I deal with that.
Oh, yeah, you do then.
Daily, I deal with it daily. And it's crazy how, you know, the funniest thing for me is when people try to mask the spending. Like, oh, but yeah, I had to go to Starbucks because you really had to? Like, you really... twice a day, but you really had to twice a day. You know, you go in Starbucks in the morning before you go to work, and then you stop on your lunch break after you go and spend money on lunch when you could bring your lunch to work. Like, it's a lot. They mask the spending. So hilarious.
Here's something I'm sorry I interrupted you. Oh. Sorry I interrupted you. I was looking up because you mentioned that, and I've got a section on that, and I'm just going to read here. What I read, I want to take advantage of this great point you made, because coffee happens to be one of the, when I'm looking at where people's money goes, and you were talking, I'm a coffee fan, you're talking, I'm taking a drink of coffee, right? It's not like I'm anti-coffee. So I wrote, there are high-end coffee outlets. Let's imagine there's a guy, and on his way to work each morning, he spends $5 on coffee. If he does this for 5 years, it's going to cost him almost $7,000. I mean, you can pay off, you know, quite a bit of debt with that. And then imagine that this gentleman starts struggling financially. And if there's a caring friend that tries to talk to him about his casual spending, you know, sadly, he's going to say that he has an income problem. He's going to blame his income, but he's going to say his boss doesn't pay him enough, or he hasn't got enough raises, or he's going to blame inflation, or all these different expenses. And if the friend tries to say, well, what do you think about the way I see you kind of spending money, you know, you're going out for coffee regularly, you and your wife are eating out pretty regularly, you tell me that you're going to the movies regularly. If you tell them, hey, maybe you shouldn't spend this money this way, then the person might shoot back and say, you know, why don't you show me chapter and verse that says that I can't go buy coffee or go to the movies or something like that. And so that's just kind of like one example that seems harmless. But when you add in, so if you got the coffee, and then you've got the movies, and then you've got the extra things you buy at Walmart or Target, and then you've got the times you go out to eat, all of these things like super add up. And yes. So it's kind of those small purchases that I like when I'm counseling people, I don't frequently see that people are in trouble financially because of some major purchase. Like they went and spent $70,000 and it ruined their life. I don't see that. Typically what I see is people that have not made major purchases. It's just a lot of small purchases that add up over time. And so, and why is that? It's because it's a lot easier to spend 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 bucks here or there than it is to write a check for $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. So most people are not usually in trouble for that $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 purchase. I mean, unless we're talking about a new vehicle, which is another discussion. Most people are in trouble because of all of those small purchases that add up over time. I was looking at just how much it costs to go to the movies. You know, with as many kids as we have, you can guess we don't really get to go. We're not huge movie people anyway, but here's something else. AMC Entertainment, it's America's most popular movie chain.
Yes.
And if I use their prices, the average movie costs $26 per person. That's $11 a ticket. Let's say soda, $6, popcorn, $9. And I took that right from their website. So that's over $50 for a couple. Then if you add in a few kids, even two kids, you're up over $100. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you add in 4, 5, 6 kids, I mean, you're looking at $200, $300 just for a movie. And it's hard to justify that when you can go rent something for, you know, a few bucks and enjoy an evening at home. And so those are the kind of things that add up that really cause people a lot of problems financially.
Yes. Because it's the small purchases. It's spending habits, really. Oh, my God. Ooh, a lot of people need to hear this, because I don't want to always seem like the bad guy. See, it's not just me, everybody.
There you go.
Yes. Oh, my God. Movies. I haven't spent full price for a movie in I don't know how long. Oh, my God. Not since
Netflix. I mean, you get a subscription to, you know, Netflix or something. Not like I'm a huge fan of Netflix, but get a subscription to a movie service for, you know, a fraction of what you pay. I mean, if we want to keep this topic going about spending problems, one of the other things that I see that I wrote about, I call it worthless purchases. And these are all things that I learned just from experience with people. And when I say worthless purchases, I don't mean that the thing you purchase has no value. I don't mean that the item itself is worthless. I mean, it's worthless to you, or it's worthless for you.
Yeah.
So in other words, even if you buy something that's like super valuable or super nice, if it just sits on a shelf and you never do anything with it, like let's say there's this article of clothing you buy, right? You've got, you see this new clothing at the store and it looks great. You love it. You buy it and it just sits in your closet. Well, that's a worthless purchase because you never did anything with it. Or that guy that goes and buys that new tool or the toys you buy your kids that they don't play with. Mm-hmm. If it never ends up being used, then that's a worthless purchase for you. And for many of us, our houses can be filled with worthless purchases. Those things we bought that we never did, you know, the woman who's buying more stuff for the kitchen or kitchenware stuff. And it's not like I'm saying, you know, you don't buy more clothes or buy kitchenware stuff. But if you don't use it, that's a worthless purchase. I used to, when I was an elementary school teacher, we'd go on these field trips and I would tell my students that you're going to go, let's say we're going to a museum or we're going to a zoo. We're almost always going someplace, some touristy type place that has some shop where they can, the kids can buy lots of, you know, knickknacks, and they're usually really overpriced. Mm-hmm. So because I was a Christian when I was a teacher, I was pretty concerned with my students' character or morality as much as their academics. So I was trying to help them grow academically, but I also wanted them to grow morally. So I would take opportunities I had to talk to them about things like, you know, honesty, hard work, service. And every time we had a field trip, that was like my opportunity to talk about finances or money. Because I know all these kids, they're going on a field trip, their parents give them, you know, $50 or something, or some $20-$30 for lunch. And I would tell the kids, look, you're going to go to this museum and you're going to want to go throw your money away on this junk in this little souvenir shop. And so one of the things that I noticed was, whenever we got back to the school and dropped all the kids off, I would walk down the aisle of the bus and make sure all the kids had all their stuff, didn't forget their backpacks. And I could look in the seats and I could see the souvenirs that they had bought that they had already become so uninterested in, they just left them in the seats right there. And so every year I would tell the students this story and I would say, you're going to buy this stuff at the souvenir shop. And within a matter of time, within only a few hours, you're already going to be so bored of it, you're probably just going to leave it on the seats in the bus. So save your money. Don't spend it that way. But of course, you know, many kids are not disciplined. They buy all that. But my whole point is adults can be like this too. We can do the exact same thing. It's not just students on a field trip.
Yes. Because as soon as you said worthless purchases, I thought about my mom. I'm like, oh my God. We call her a hoarder, but she's got a lot better now. But oh my God, like it got so bad that I wouldn't even go to the store to buy comforter sets. I would just go to my mom's house. Huh. I will go to my mom. If I need curtains, I'm going to my mom's house. It's crazy. Like, I'm like, why do you buy all this stuff? Oh, it was on sale.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the other things you mentioned, hoarding. And I wrote about this too, but hoarding causes anxiety or stress. Our stuff causes us stress. I mean, the more stuff you have, there's a lot of stress associated with stuff. There's kind of this idea that your possessions can start possessing you, if that makes sense. Your possessions possess you because you have to take care of them, put them away, you know, use them. If you buy the boat, and I'm not saying people shouldn't buy boats or something. There's a lot of families in our church that have bought boats. And then when we go to camp, they use their boats as a, and it blesses the whole church family. But you buy your boat and then suddenly you feel like you have to use it. So there's all this anxiety. Well, we got our boat. We need to go out and use it. We need to make sure we do this. You know, we got our skis. We have to go make sure we're skiing enough because we bought our skis. We have all our ski equipment. And so whenever you have this stuff, it starts, your possessions start possessing you, but you also have to find places for it, you know, in your house. And when there's clutter, there's studies that show the amount of stress or anxiety that clutter causes. Probably anxiety that clutter causes just when you go into your mom's house, you know, that ends up stressing you out. But all of that clutter is anxiety causing. And so there's even, not only is it better financially not to live simply, to pursue a simpler lifestyle, it's also better, not just financially, but in, from a stress level, anxiety, it's easier to keep a home tidy to, you know, and with a bunch of kids, we don't, it's not like we have a, we don't have a mansion or something. So we can't, we can't let our kids each have a whole ton of stuff or else our home, you know, we'd have to make an aisle through all of the stuff just to get from one part of the house to the other.
I have to ask her, I wonder if she started doing that because she did have a lot of kids and she just haven't, you know, worked herself out of that mindset yet. Because, yeah, you have a lot of kids. I guess she was keeping a lot of things. You know, we're going to need sheets and we're going to need towels and we're going to need curtains. And maybe that's why she does it. But it has gotten a lot better. She used to keep one room in her house just full of stuff. And it's like, why? Like, why? She has, like, universal remotes and
God, when am I gonna need it? Yeah, that's right. Kind of my feeling. When am I gonna need it?
Oh my God. Yeah. But yeah, she got a lot better. She doesn't have the room anymore, but she has a walk-in closet and we're slowly working on her with it, but she's gotten a lot better. I can't get any comforter sets anymore, so now it's on to Target, but yeah. So what do you think are the most common financial problems that people are facing?
Yeah, so I think we've talked about two of them, or at least one of them. One of them is the small purchases that add up. So I don't think we need to talk about that any further. I would also say the worthless purchases, which we kind of talked about, those things that we don't end up using or we don't end up needing, that ends up, I notice a lot of people, and we're guilty of this too. It's not like we're perfect in this area or something. Buying things we don't need. And I'd say one of the biggest issues, which is a very moral or spiritual issue, is self-entitlement. Self-entitlement. I deserve this. I should have this. Sometimes we lie. We don't even, might not even know we're lying. And we say, I need this. We don't really need it. You know, we like to say things so that we feel better. Like if I say I need it, then I feel justified in getting it because I've told myself that I need it. The truth is I just want it. There's only a few things we need. Like in 1 Timothy 6, Paul says, with these things, we shall be content. He says food and clothing, you know, and it also, the Greek word includes housing or, you know, a roof over your head. And it says, with these things, I shall be content. And so if you have food, clothing, and a roof over your head, then you should be content. We don't really need to have these other things, but entitlement is one of the major causes of bad financial decisions or bad purchases. You know, I deserve this. I should have this. I've worked hard at my job or at my school, or I had this breakup and now I'm hurting and I need to do something. I need to take care of myself. I need to love myself, or I need to reward myself. And I'm not even saying there's not a place for rewards. Like I would say, this is one thing I would encourage any families that are listening. If you have children and you're trying to pay off debt, talk to your children about a reward once all the debt's paid off, like a trip you're going to take, a vacation you're going to go on. Hopefully not one that's going to be tens of thousands of dollars and put you back in debt. But when Katie was trying to save up some money for something, she made kind of that thermometer model where it shows like on the thermometer how much you're saving. Well, that gets kids excited. You know, then they're enthusiastic and then kids are less inclined. Now kids don't want to spend all your money because they're part of this journey of getting out of debt. So if you can involve the kids, I think that that's a really good process. So we try to talk to our children about things we're doing. We have some investments with real estate and our kids are familiar with that. I actually invested some money and I allowed my kids to invest with me. And I said, hey, if you want to invest, we'll record how much, because my, you know, at their age, they don't need this money for years until maybe they buy a vehicle, or, you know, if they're like 10 to 14, they might not need this for 5-6 years. So why don't we invest it and let this money grow, and then you'll get that money returned to you in the future. And so I think it's really good to try to involve the family in that journey and to talk to them about not being entitled. It's good for our kids to hear no. It's good as parents and adults to say no to certain things. And we see a lot of the problems with entitlement in the Bible. I mean, that's really how the first sin happened, or how the fall happened. The devil came to Eve and basically said, shouldn't you be able to eat this? You know, don't you want it? God doesn't want you to be wise. God's trying to keep you down and ruin your life. And God doesn't want you to be happy, but you deserve to be happy. You should have this. Go ahead and eat this. And so entitlement is a very common theme in scripture when people get in trouble. And it also is a very common theme with finances. One of the other things that I'd say that causes problems is impatience. There's especially in Proverbs about the dangers of being hasty or acting quickly. And I think that has immense application to finances. I mean, there's lots of ways whenever we act hastily or too quick that we can get into trouble, but especially with finances, because like you kind of said it with your mom, I don't know her, but my suspicion is you told me that she says it was on sale. Well, that's code for, I have to buy it now. This is a once in a life opportunity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not going to be on sale next week, which isn't really true. This is something else I try to tell people. If you just think about this, whenever you want to buy something, have you ever noticed that you can almost always find good opportunities to buy it, or you can almost always find sales or deals? Just think about it. Whenever you want to buy something, you will almost always be able to find what looks like good deals or sales for that purchase. Well, why is that? It's not because you're just like super, it's not a huge coincidence. It's not because God is just like super blessing you. And whenever you want to buy something, he lets you find a good deal. I was a business major in college, and this is marketing. This is good marketing. Yes. And so stores make you feel like you're getting a good deal. That's how they work. Good sellers don't make you feel ripped off. Good sellers make you feel like you're getting a good deal. Right. And so you will regularly see things that make you think you're getting a good deal so that you're more inclined to buy it. And that's actually one of the other spending problems people have is they don't understand good deals. They think they're getting a good deal when they're really not. And if I'm talking too much, you can just interrupt me or something.
This is good.
Okay. So the balance to this is there actually are good deals though. We can find good deals. And so I'm not saying there's never good deals, but it begs the question, then how do we know when we're really getting a good deal or not? And the answer is there's only one way to know, and that's by research. You've got to do your research. And so I'll give you an example from our lives. So we had a van and minivan. And then as our family grew, we couldn't fit in the minivan anymore. We needed a 15 passenger van. And I'm not an automotive guy. I don't work on vehicles. I didn't know what a van cost. And so I created this Excel spreadsheet, and I was recording the prices of all of these minivans or all of these 15 passenger vans that I found for sale online. And I would record like the miles, the year, the price, the condition. And I kind of had this little formula so that I could see when something looked like a good deal. And then most of the vans are about kind of the same price. You know, you kind of, after you're researching this for a few weeks, you develop a really good understanding of what something should cost when it has this many miles or when it's this year. You know, you can look and say, okay, that's pretty average. That's average. Oh, that's a horrible deal. They're trying to rip me off. Yeah. And then you can see when something's a good deal. So I was doing this for maybe like a month and had, you know, 50 to 100, 15 passenger vans in the spreadsheet. And I wake up one day and the same thing I do each day, which is add a couple vehicles to my spreadsheet to see when something comes up that's a good deal. And there's this one van that was for sale and it just kind of like shot off the page. It just looked like a super great deal. It looked like so good of a deal. I was concerned that it was a mistake. So I called the gentleman selling the van and I said, I'm interested in your van. I just want to make sure that these numbers that I'm seeing are correct. And he said something like, man, you're fast because I just listed this like, you know, two minutes ago. Wow. And I said, he said, yeah, that's correct. I'm selling it for a friend. And I said, okay, well, it's 4 hours away and I'm willing to drive there right now to buy it. I just don't want to drive there and have you sell it out from under me. So will you promise to keep it until I get there? And he said, yes, if you leave right now, you know, I won't sell it until you get, I'll give you 4 or 5 hours to get here. And I said, okay. So I get in the car with my dad. We drive over to pick it up and, you know, it looked great. It looked like it was a new condition. And it was funny. I had this kangaroo logo on the side. And I asked the gentleman, I said, hey, if you don't mind me asking, you know, what's kind of the story with this? And he said, well, there's a restaurant here called The Roo. you know, hence Kangaroo. And the restaurant owner bought this van for his business and he never used it. And it just sat here under, you know, in his garage at the restaurant and he just wants to get rid of it. And so he asked me to sell it for him. And that's why there was hardly any miles on it and it was in great condition. And I said, okay, well, I didn't tell this guy, but honestly, I thought he could have gotten way more money for it. And he told, and the guy that sold it to me said, I think I can tell that you're getting a very good deal because since you called me, like, you know, 80 other people have called me. And so if you're not interested, there's, I'll be able to sell this super easily. But my whole point is I would not have known that that was a good deal if I hadn't been, you know, doing my research. And so I've heard people, I'm not kidding, tell me they got a good deal and I could tell that they didn't get a good deal, but because they thought it was on sale or whatever, you know, the seller convinced them it was a good deal. You can't let the seller convince you something is a good deal. So you have to do your research. And that kind of brings me to the other major problem for people is impatience. They're just not patient. This kind of relates to being hasty. Yeah. So one of the strategies that I tell people that Katie and I have tried to apply is when we want to buy something, we wait at least 2 weeks. And if you want to be more certain, you can wait a month. Well, the reason that I do this or recommend this to people is most of the regret that people experience associated with a bad purchase comes within a week or two after the purchase. And so if you wait that 2 weeks, you can typically avoid experiencing that regret. And so many times if I tell people, hey, wait 2 weeks, they're going to wait a week and they're going to say, man, I'm super glad I didn't buy that. You know, a lot of people are going to come to that conclusion that it would have been a really bad purchase and it was really great that they didn't go through with it. But if you wait the 2 weeks and you still want to buy it, and hopefully during that 2 weeks, you're also doing your research, then you can be really confident that you are making a good decision and that it is something you should buy. And so choose like a number. Say in our home, if we're going to buy anything more than $10,000 or $5,000, we're going to wait at least 2 weeks to make sure that we still want to buy it in the future. And for many people, that will help them avoid those bad purchases and avoid all the guilt and regret that they would have experienced if they would have went forward with that purchase. There's a study. Have you ever heard of the Stanford Marshmallow Experiment by chance?
A little bit. I don't know fully what it is.
Okay. So the Stanford Marshmallow Experiment is this super entertaining but also informative study that the university, Stanford University, did involving a lot of children. And so what happened was they brought all these children one at a time into a room and they put them at this table and there's a little plate with a marshmallow on it. And they told the kids, if you will wait, you can eat this marshmallow right now, but if you will wait, then I will come back and I'll give you a second marshmallow. And you can look this up on the internet. There's like YouTube videos of this. It's great. I mean, you can see these kids and they're sitting at the table and they're like wringing their hands. They're licking their lips. They're trying to exhibit all this self-control. You're like almost rooting for them. You're like, come on, you can do it. You know, be patient, be self-controlled. And so obviously all of the kids fell into one of two categories, the kids who ate the marshmallow or the kids who waited until they got a second marshmallow. But that's only the beginning of the study. So they follow these kids over the next 20 years of their lives.
Oh, wow.
To see how these kids did in the future. And they found overwhelming evidence that the kids who waited for the second marshmallow did significantly better in like every area of life than the people who didn't wait. And so the point is having self-control, being disciplined, learning to be patient are skills that allow us to be much more successful in like every area of life. And so when the Bible praises patience, when the Bible talks really highly about patience, it does so for good reason. Because if you can apply patience, you can apply patience to like most areas of life, relationships, obviously finances. And so, and then those kids who did eat the marshmallow and were not patient, they found were, you know, did poorly compared to the other kids.
Wow. Yeah, I like that. I like that 2 week waiting process. It just made me think about a mortgage. There's always a process when you're buying a house. So that's a good idea, waiting to make those big purchases. Well, not even big purchases, just those impulse buys. Just wait on it. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure it's something that you're, you know, is worth it. Just like buying a house. You just mm-hmm. can't walk in and say, okay, this is my house here. Not unless you're buying the cash. I mean, hey. Uh-huh. But there's a process. You have to do inspections and appraisals and things like that. And a lot of people don't like waiting, but most of the time it works out for your good. So yeah, that's good. You mean thinking about different purchases in that way, that would help a lot of people mm-hmm. from making these crappy purchases that have them sitting in my office looking crazy.
A house is a huge purchase. That's definitely one you should do your research. And I don't think most of us know what necessarily a good or bad house price is. And so you need to start your spreadsheet, you know, look at square footage, look at the year the house was built, look at the inspection. And then once you're doing this research, you're going to end up, because some people sell a house and they have to sell tomorrow. You know, they get a guy, let's just say there's a guy that gets transferred or gets a promotion. He's got to move across the country. He doesn't have time for his house to sit on the market for 6 months. He needs to mm-hmm. sell his house as soon as possible so that he can buy his new house. That's the person whose house you want to buy because they have to market their house to sell. Yeah. But there's other people who are just sitting on their house and they don't really care. They're not in a hurry. And so they don't market it to sell. Well, you don't really know who's marketing their house to sell until you do your research.
Right.
And so when you do your research, and then you can see, wow, these people are just trying to get out of their house as soon as possible. They'll take a low offer. I mean, on this great house. So that's what you really want to be looking at.
Wow. Yeah. Great points. Great point. Ooh, this is good. Okay. So what do you think? Why do you think Christians struggle with finances and their money, particularly pertaining to Christians?
I'd say for many of those reasons that I shared earlier, I don't think that it's necessarily different for Christians versus non-Christians. Mm-hmm. I think that for many Christians, at least a lot of the circles that I'm familiar with, the wives might not work. And so mm-hmm. like in our church, we have a lot of homeschooling mothers. And so part of it is not really their fault. They just make less money because they're a single income versus a double income family, or even families that don't homeschool. They just have young children. Wives stay home. Titus 2 talks about women being homemakers. Proverbs mm-hmm. 31, this woman, she was industrious, the Proverbs 31 woman. She bought and sold land, but she's also very focused on her home. Yeah. And so it's not to say a woman can't make money or contribute financially, but if you have women in the Christian world who are homemakers or taking care of their homes, they're not going to be making as much money. And so that just makes finances tighter. Plus, hopefully Christians are giving money to the church, to the kingdom of God. And so that's going to be, I don't want to say an expense, but that other non-Christians don't have.
Yeah. Well, I know I had an issue with money, and it's crazy that I came to this revelation like 2 years ago, actually. So I've been a tax accountant for, should be year 11 now. And this is crazy. And I didn't have the best relationship with money in the sense that, when I was little and my Nana brought me to church and I heard the pastor say that it was hard for a rich man to get into the kingdom of heaven. And so I was so scared. I was like, I'm never going to be rich. I don't want a lot of money. I got to go see God. If I make too much money, I'm not going to be able to see God. So I guess that was always in the back of my mind, you know. And so right after the pandemic, I have a tax practice. So I have a tax office. I'm a bookkeeping expert for Intuit QuickBooks. And I also opened a restaurant. And so I had all those things going at the same time. And I started to make money. And I'm a tither. I believe in tithes. I got to give God what he gave me. So I give him his things back. I am a tither. So I started making this money that I actually prayed for, which is crazy. I prayed for an amount. I surpassed the amount, and then I got nervous and I was like, oh no, I gotta stop. I gotta stop. And then I had the revelation that I didn't trust God with my finances. I wanted to control that. I wanted to say, okay, this is what I'm going for ties. This is this, but he has other plans for me and I can't limit him in that way because I'm limiting myself, but I fully have to trust him in everything. And finances for me was a part that I guess I was kind of keeping for myself because, okay, I know about this. This is my field. I'm an expert, quote unquote, in this. So this is something I already know about. Oh, but he had to deal with me on that.
Yeah, it definitely, generosity or giving is more of a reflection of our faith or trust, more of a reflection of our relationship with the Lord than it is actually a reflection of our finances. I mean, there's people that have a lot of money who are stingy, and there's people that don't have much money and are generous. And so being generous or giving says more about our relationship with the Lord than it says about how much money we have in our accounts.
Yeah. Yeah. He had to deal with me. It was, I was tithing because I knew that I had to tithe. It's almost like doing chores, you know, that you have to do chores. They have to be done. So yeah, I'm going to tithe, but he dealt with me. You don't give, because, hey, you know, I got to get up and put the dishes in the dishwasher. That's not how you should feel about tithing. That's not how you should feel about giving what God has given you. And so, yeah, he had to deal with me with the finances because I just knew that I knew everything. It was crazy. I got one more question for you before I let you go. Okay. What do you believe is your purpose?
My purpose, I mean, I could make this very simple or it could be very long, but my purpose is to serve Christ. He saved me. He redeemed me from sin and death. And so that's my purpose. Now, underneath that, what does that purpose look like? You know, as it's carried out, then I would say it's being a husband to Katie. It's being a father to the 10 children that God's bless me with. It's being a pastor to the church that he allows me to serve. And then after that, it's, you know, hopefully blessing people with my books or my speaking. I do some speaking throughout the year as well. But primarily, you know, my life should be to glorify Christ and exalt him and to bring him glory and not to bring myself glory, but to let others know him hopefully through my life and through what I do for him. So, and that would be my greatest encouragement to any of your listeners too, is to pursue Christ. And, you know, if you've never repented of your sins and looked to Christ to be saved, then that would be the greatest advice I could give you. It wouldn't be any of the financial stuff that I said in the show up to this point. It would be that, to look to Christ to be saved and serve him.
Yes. Praise God. And can you name all 10 of your kids?
Oh yeah. So we've got Rhea. Ricky's named after my father-in-law, Johnny, who's named after my father. And then charis, which is the Greek word for grace related to the word charity, charis, charity. Mm-hmm. Chloe, Noah, Ruby, Lydia, George, and Hudson. Rhea, Ricky, Johnny, charis, Chloe, Noah, Ruby, Lydia, and George. Yeah, and then Hudson. And so George is named after George Mueller. So if you want to talk about finances, George Mueller was this incredible godly man who started all these orphanages. George Mueller has all these famous stories, you know, they're like legendary stories about his faith and about God providing. So if you want to read a biography about finances, definitely I'd encourage you to read George Mueller's biography. Mm-hmm. And our son is named after our ninth child is named after George. And then our newest child Hudson is named after Hudson Taylor, who was that missionary to China. He's behind China Inland Mission. So those are our 10 kids.
Oh, inspiring. That was awesome. I wanted to see if you can name them because my mom used to say,
Well, I can get them wrong when I'm, you know, I can name them, but if you see me talking in the house and I like this morning, I called Ruby Lydia. And so I definitely, definitely foul up like that.
Oh my God, it's so funny. Okay, do you have any last words for the audience? Anything you want to let them know that you have coming up or how to connect with you?
Oh, great. Thank you. So I've been working on another book, Contentment, Being Content God's Way. So that's kind of my brand, God's Way, you know, your marriage God's way, your finances God's way, and enduring trials God's way, and now Being Content God's Way. And I enjoy doing marriage conferences, you know, or finance conferences as well. But if any of your listeners are interested in hosting one of my conferences, they can reach out to me through my website. That's where people could find me. So you'll have my website in the show notes, scottlapierre.org, just my name, scottlapierre.org. And I've got a free gift for your listeners. If they go there, there's a free booklet they can download. It's not a novel, not a huge thing to read. It's called 7 Biblical Insights for Marriage. And that's just something I want to give people to help prepare them for marriage or strengthen their marriages. And my website's also where people can find my conference messages, my sermons, my books, and if they have any questions or I can help them in any way, they can reach out to me through the contact page on my website as well.
Awesome. Oh, I got to go look for that booklet. I'm getting into the dating. Well, I'm in the dating pool. I've been praying for my new spouse for the last 2 years. So, yeah, I got to get that booklet. Yes. I can learn how to be a good wife.
There you go.
Yes. Thank you so much, Pastor Scott LaPierre.
Thank you, Chandra. I appreciate what you're doing. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time and your talent.
Okay.
I'm going to let you go. Bye-bye.
All right. God bless you and your listeners. Bye.
Thank you so much for hanging out with us today on the Who God Says podcast with your host and Kingdom Ambassador, Ty Chandra. Go to whogodsays.com to join the mailing list for episode premieres, upcoming guests, and more. Send in your questions to be a part of the show at whogodsays@gmail.com. And don't forget, join the Kingdom Fanatic community. Until next time, be blessed and also be a blessing.